house on its own plot of land. You've got the kind of equality in the war years of the man and the woman up in the top left-hand box. By the end, you've got the woman who is the kind of passive, in a sense, inferior figure in the cartoon. But the poem itself is kind of selling this dream of suburban living. It's also selling Windex, of course. It's an interesting poem, partly, you know, because of the message, but partly because it does illustrate how widespread poetry and poetry reading was in the post-war years. You often get poets saying, oh, there's no audience for poetry anymore, nobody buys poetry. You know, this is poets in the 40s and 50s. Actually, millions of people were buying and reading poetry. It may not have been in a single slim collection, but nevertheless, poetry had an avid and wide audience at this time. The Saturday Evening Post, for instance, had a circulation of 4 million, a weekly circulation of 4 million. So you have this this cartoon here, which is this advert, which is kind of selling the dream of these new suburban homes. But not everyone in the United States was quite so enthusiastic. And the poem we're going to hear in a moment, which is the first poem of several that we're going to hear, was published in the Saturday Evening Post. And it tells us something about the ideological debates of the time. The poem is called We Must Have Homes. It's by an unknown poet called William Pratt. And the poem shows us that the pressure was on for the whole nation to accept suburban development as part of its patriotic duty. When you hear the poem, which Mark's going to read in a second, just listen out for the regular rhyming couplets, because these make the poem seem familiar and accessible to a mass market audience, the Saturday Evening Post audience. But it also shows us in poetic terms the process the poem itself is talking about. The poem is talking about measuring and demarcating parcels of land for development. And the poem itself is kind of measured out and demarcated in a way that really illustrates that theme. So I'll pass over to Mark.
For three generations, this homestead of mine, surrounded by acres of maple and pine, has been far removed from the thundering cry that sounds in the streets of the city nearby. But slowly, like tentacles fitted with claws, the workmen come creeping with axes and saws to ravish the trees in whose sheltering shade our three generations of children have played. And give not a thought to the sudden despair of gay little ghosts who are frolicking there. The transit men measure the windows and hills. Construction men gather with tractors and drills. And all the perfection of God's noble plan must bow to the stilted arrangement of man. The creek will be veered from its natural course, and fields once so laden with daisy and gorse will soon be divided in neat little squares to face on the curbing of new thoroughfares. The loud auctioneering and riotous bids will bring on a bedlam of neighborhood kids. But now that the hubbub is here at my door, I face it. Can reason do anything more than watch the sad meeting of boot heel and weed as workmen make way for a nation in need? With hopes for humanity chasing my frown, I stand on my threshold to welcome a town.
Thanks, Mark. This is great for me because I've never heard these poems read out loud before. So this is wonderful. So what we get in that poem is this really persuasive rhythm and a really reassuring rhyme scheme. And we have the extended metaphor of childhood. So you have the ghosts of the past giving way to the noisy and lively bedlam of neighbourhood kids towards the end. And that persuades us as readers to accept the inevitability of change, to sacrifice our own nostalgia for the peaceful past in order to support the present and future needs of the nation. A further driver of suburban development in the US in the post-war years was the modernisation of building materials and techniques. Historically in the US, houses were built by small-scale carpenter builders using local vernacular materials. By the late 1940s, everything had changed. as a consequence of wartime innovation, you have all sorts of new materials like load-bearing steel, aluminium, plate glass windows, new forms of plastic. And you have new techniques like the mechanisation of the building process. And suddenly, from the sort of late 1940s onwards, it becomes possible and economically feasible to mass produce homes for this huge market. Again, popular magazines and popular poetry played a role in introducing these new techniques to an audience of house hunters. This is a feature in the Ladies' Home Journal, January 1945, one of a series which was about modern architecture. And the series aims, in effect, to sell these modern new ideas and styles to an audience, persuading readers, I mean, this is before the end of the war, of course, persuading the readers of what might be available once the war is over. In the post-war US, as you can see from this prototype, the plate glass window and the open plan layout are distinctive markers of the modern, of the new. A consequence of the use of plate glass like this and open plan layouts is that there's a kind of blurring of the boundaries between the inside and the outside, between adult spaces and children's spaces, between the private and the public. And these were designed to encourage the easy, informal living, which is regarded as a characteristic of the democratic American way. Again, though, not everyone was persuaded by this vision. Here's another poem, again by an amateur poet, Dorothy Albaugh, again from Saturday Evening Post. This poem's called Lines to an Architect. It's rather like the poem we've just heard. It's quite regular and traditional in its metre. And what Albaugh is doing here is lamenting the move away from strictly demarcated private spaces, the dining room, the mid-Victorian, you know, style and so on. And she's lamenting the move towards the easy, open-plan living. The final couplets of the poem warn, "Be careful. Be careful, builder, in your zeal for art, lest you design a house without a heart." There's this kind of horrible anxiety tied in. You know, if you open out the interior of the home, are you somehow debasing the structures of the American family, and so on and so on. Who would have thought that architecture had so much in it? A slightly later poem by John Updike also evokes contemporary concern about the lack of privacy that came with this new style of architecture. As we see in this cartoon, this is late 1960s, I think this is about 67, I haven't been able to find a date for this one. In this cartoon, again from the Saturday Evening Post, we can see this kind of shared concern, this kind of widely shared concern about the way in which the visibility of the suburbs, the plate glass design of the suburbs, made you vulnerable to being watched by your neighbours. Here's John Updike's poem that Mark's going to read for us. It's called Suburban Madrigal.
Sitting here in my house, looking through my windows diagonally at my neighbor's house, I see his sun porch windows. They are filled with blue-green, the blue-green of my car, which I parked in front of my house, more or less, up the street, where I can't directly see it. How promiscuous is the world of appearances? How frail are property laws? To him, his window is filled with his things, his lamps, his plants, his radio. How annoyed he would be to know that my car, legally parked, yet violates his windows, paints them full to me, of myself, my car, my well-insured 55 four-door Ford, a gorgeous green sunset streaking his panes.
So that poem, a terrific Updike poem from Updike's second collection, Telephone Poles, is just one of many poems in the period to draw on that image of the picture window as part of its narrative and as a symbol of suburban life. The madrigal of the title, as some of you will know, is a complex musical form that's dependent on multiple interacting parts. So it's interesting to me that he calls this a madrigal because he's talking about this complex interrelationship of the two neighbours, their kind of mutual dependency. So the poem opens with the speaker proudly locating himself at the centre of his modern suburban home, looking out through the exact same kind of feature windows as we saw in that article from the Ladies Home Journal with the kind of plan on it, the house design. There he is, sitting in my house, looking through my windows, diagonally at my neighbour's house. But of course, what he sees when he looks out are his neighbour's windows, filled with the blue-green of his own car. And the speaker's proud of that sleight of hand. He's managed both to keep an eye on his car and to avoid spoiling his own direct view by parking the car in a way that he can just keep an eye on its reflection without having to look at the thing itself. So the often celebrated neighbourly spirit of the suburbs is put to the test here as one party, the speaker himself, imposes himself on the other. And this is that sort of central section from the poem. To him, his window is filled with his things. How annoyed he would be. There's a kind of real pleasure in provoking the neighbour here. Interestingly, the neighbour himself is never seen, and this is quite a characteristic of poetry of the suburbs. You actually see very few people in the suburbs. You have the voice of the poem, but often the suburban landscapes are actually empty, devoid of people. And in this poem, we know the neighbour only by his possessions, his plants, his radio, and so on. There's a sort of covert sign here of the acquisitiveness of the post-war suburbs. Critics such as the architectural historian Lewis Mumford were scathing about that kind of acquisitiveness, that consumerism. He was scathing about the bland sameness of the post-war purpose-built suburbs. And here's how he described them. He said the suburbs represent a multitude of uniform, unidentifiable houses lined up inflexibly at uniform distances on uniform roads in a treeless communal waste, inhabited by people of the same class, the same income, the same age group, witnessing the same television performances, eating the same tasteless prefabricated foods from the same freezers, conforming in every outward and inward respect to a common mould. And that was quite typical, actually, of the kind of critical hostility to the suburbs at this time. Aerial photos of the suburb, like this one, a very, very famous sequence of photos taken by a photographer called William Garnett and published in Fortune magazine in 1950. This is of Lakewood in California. And this kind of perpetuates that idea that the suburbs are just this absolute homogenous mass, every house exactly the same, a kind of blueprint, if you like. The next poet we're going to look at, a Californian poet, Josephine Miles, reflects on these Californian landscapes in a series of poems from the late 1930s through to the early 1980s. Now, Josephine Miles is not a name who's known to us today, although she was a highly accomplished poet and an academic in her time. In fact, she was the first woman to gain a chair at the University of California at Berkeley. Her 1939 poem, Approach, takes as its subject the kind of travails of a hosiery salesman, which is kind of a sort of comic figure in a sense, but anyway, he's a hosiery salesman, and his lot in life is to sort of plod up and down these kind of suburban housing estates. And it's a sort of modern-day purgatory where he's trying to sell tights and stockings and so on door to door. So Mark's going to read the poem now.
The hosiery salesman walking up the hill holds out for mercy and receives it not. Perceiving at the top against his will how flat the blocks ahead are and how hot. How from porch to porch and hedge to hedge in neo-Spanish neatness of design there is a long perspective of arch and edge, of roof and step, and little out of line. These doors will close to his toe, one like the rest. The cool interiors be black to his sight. No eager discourse on what silk is best will sound right in his ear, will sound in his ears right. How shall a man proceed among the noises of scooters, rakes, and babies on the lawn when the sober Spanish doors and the cool voices reject all small familiars but their own.
So the salesman in this poem, who's a kind of mid-century Sisyphus, is condemned in perpetuity to walk up this suburban hill, kind of carting his burden before him. It's a clever poem, the inversion in the second line that Mark read, where the salesman holds out for mercy but receives it not. The rhyme on that word and the inversion really emphasises the thanklessness of his task. And a bit like the other poems we've already looked at, that the regular, usually iambic, line and the rising rhythms replicate the monotony of suburban housing, as we see in the kind of William Garnett picture here. And the monosyllabic rhymes, not and hot, for example, reiterate that point. The suburban world is constituted by boundaries and borders, by blocks and the hedge and the arch, the edge, the step and the line, as we see in this stanza. The poem makes it clear that the salesman is out of place in this feminized territory, powerless to penetrate the cool interior of the suburban home. As we see from this poem about the salesman and also from those objects, the plant and the radio and so on, in the John Updike suburban madrigal poem, by the early 1950s, the American suburbs had become a consumer paradise. Built, as I've suggested, for the GI generation who were anxious to start families and enjoy the fruits of war, the growth of the suburbs was stimulated by former military suppliers like General Electric, Westinghouse, and General Motors, who were hell-bent on devising new products and finding new markets to fill the gap in their order books from the end of the war. John Updike's wonderful 1958 poem, Bendix, helps set the scene.
This porthole overlooks a sea forever falling from the sky. The water inextricably involved with buttons, suds, and dye. Like bits of shrapnel, shards of foam fly heavenward. A bedsheet heaves. A stocking wrestles with a comb. And cotton angels wave their sleeves. The boiling purgatorial tide resolves our dreary shorts and slips, while mother coolly bakes beside her little jugged apocalypse.
So, as the title indicates, the poem celebrates the Bendix washing machine. It succeeds, even though it's quite an unpromising theme, by mixing the mundane, the washing machine, with the fantastical, the cotton angels that we see in stanza two there. It mixes the everyday, the forever falling laundry, with the sublime. You get these metaphors of the heavens. The ABAB rhyme scheme, although predictable, has enough in it, retains enough of interest, like the rhyme on sea and inextricably slips apocalypse. It captures the reader's attention and challenges our assumptions about the triviality of the theme. The poem depicts the mechanisation of domesticity at this time, but it also tells us something about gender roles. Women worked in huge numbers during the war years, but by the end of the 1940s had, in effect, been pushed back home. And here we have an advert from, this is Ladies' Home Journal, if I remember rightly. New technologies, such as the Bendix washing machine, which is one of the first front loaders, as you see on that advert, were designed to appeal both to female users and to male buyers. So to this end, the new technology, like the Bendix, often used this newfangled push-button technology. And this was not, in fact, necessary. You didn't have to have push-button. There were other devices you could have used. But push-button technology was put into things like Bendix, in part so as to appear irresistibly modern, almost kind of space age, and in part so as to appeal to male purchasers, who, to cite one contemporary critic, were, to quote, willing to become domesticated only if they could flatter themselves that they'd been promoted from dishwashers to operators of dishwashers. So So the choice of Bendix as Updike's subject and title gestures towards, and it's got a kind of subtext, it gestures towards the growth of one of the best known post-war suburban developments, and that's Levitt Town, that some of you may have heard of. There was a Levitt Town on Long Island, there was one in Pennsylvania, and there were several others subsequently. Pennsylvania, incidentally, is John Updike's home state. Bill Levitt, who was Levitt Town's builder, famously installed Bendix appliances as standard in his new suburban homes, as incidentally did the builders of Lakewood, the suburb we saw in the William Garnett photos in California. Here's the advert, and this is not a bad washing machine. I would say that's actually fairly modern, even by today's standards. This is what the actual Bendix looks like. It's this tiny little weird drum thing hidden under the stairs there. That's the real Bendix you got if you went to a Levitt Town house. So Bill Levitt installed those as standard. But what he also did was impose ordinances on the houses which prevented women from hanging out the washing in the evenings and at weekends when the men were around. So you were only allowed to hang out your washing, in effect, between 9 and 5, Monday to Friday. So in Updike's poem, the speaker's familiarity with the scene, with the rituals of the laundry, which should be hidden from men's eyes, gives the poem this kind of slight kind of edge. It's a kind of, there's something a little bit transgressive, almost something a little bit queer about the poem. You've got this boy or this young man who seems to know an awful lot about this feminine sphere, the laundry and so on. So there's a kind of little, you know, it's a poem about a washing machine, and to some extent it's no more and no less than that, but it's got some sort of hidden layers to it. Now, many women were, of course, delighted to leave their war work. They were delighted to leave noisy factories and at last be able to settle and have their own home and start a family and so on. One of the great champions of women's housewifely roles was the now forgotten poet Phyllis McGinley. McGinley was born in 1905 in Oregon, and she lived most of her life in the New York suburbs. She was labelled the poet laureate of suburbia, and she wrote light verse and other poetry for The New Yorker. She wrote numerous best-selling books of poetry. She wrote a book in 1964 as a riposte to Betty Friedan's The Feminine Mystique. She was rabidly, we might say, anti-feminist. In 1961, she won the Pulitzer Prize for poetry for a collection which had her foreword by W.H. Auden. You know, she was incredibly celebrated in her time, but she's almost disappeared from trace in the years since. She was a huge influence on poets of the next generation, poets like Anne Sexton and Sylvia Plath and so on. Although Plath herself, I think perhaps recognising that it wasn't going to do her literary reputation any good to identify herself with the poet laureate of the suburbs, Plath kind of disavowed that influence. In 1958, writing in her journal, Plath says, "Oh, Phyllis McGinley is out, light verse, she sold herself." So she kind of turns her back on that model, perhaps sensibly. Even so, McGinley's a really fascinating case study for a number of reasons. First of all, her poetry celebrates suburban life at a time when actually the dream was starting to turn sour. And this is one of the reasons why she's fallen from favour. She was on the kind of pro-suburbs side at the point when society was beginning to think the suburbs were dull and deathly and so on and so forth. She's interesting as well because she managed to acquire a voice and a career, in fact, as a defender of the suburbs, all suburbs, even though the suburb she herself lived in, which is Larchmont in Westchester County, was a very elite turn-of-the-century enclave, completely atypical of the mass-market developments. This is actually her house here with the typical white picket fence and so on. She's interesting as well because she managed to defend the suburbs and she managed to kind of speak out for the role of the suburban housewife, even though she was living and succeeding as a professional writer. At her peak, she was earning in today's money, what would be $160,000 a year from her writing. She was earning more than her husband. I mean, $160,000 a year from writing, you know, we'd all love that, wouldn't we? So she was a professional woman, even as she was writing about how important it was for women not to take on professions, but to kind of accept their role as housewives. So there's a really interesting ambiguity in her own position, and I think we see that in the poetry itself. There are so many McGinley poems I could have chosen, but I picked one, a 1946 poem called Occupation Housewife, which Mark's going to read now.
Her health is good. She owns to 41, keeps her hair bright by vegetable rinses, has two well-nourished children, daughter and son, just now away at school. Her house, with chintzes expensively curtained, animates the caller. And she is fond of early American glass stacked in an English breakfront, somewhat taller than her best friend's. Last year, she took a class in modern drama at the county center. Twice on Good Friday, she heard Parsifal sung. She often says she might have been a painter or maybe a writer, but she married young. She diets. And with contract, she delays the encroaching isolation of her days.
If any of you know Richard Yates's book, Revolutionary Road, you'll perhaps have picked up from that poem the allusion to the woman who once a month goes to, you know, her theatre group at the community centre, because this is, of course, how April Wheeler's tragic story starts in Revolutionary Road, some sort of 10, 15 years later. So what we see here in this poem, which is pretty typical of a McGinley poem, is we see her slowly peeling away the suburban surface. The poem begins by cataloguing the many things about which the suburban housewife might feel proud: her health, her youthfulness. You know, she owns to 41. She may be older than that, but she can get away with it. The children who are educated away from home, the antique collection, and so on. But all this is superficial. And that sort of devastating final section that Mark wrote, with the falling rhythms, you get this kind of sense of decline, reveal that there's nothing here but regret for what might have been, the encroaching desolation of her days. So in this and lots of other examples, McGinley's poems seem to celebrate middle-class suburban life, while simultaneously inviting quite different, contradictory readings. Now, McGinley was criticised in her own time for painting an idealised portrait of middle-class white suburbia. And for all sorts of reasons which I don't have time to go into here, this kind of accusation that she was really speaking only about white experience is kind of slightly unfair. You know, it's clear from lots of her essays, for instance, that she was very conscious about the growing civil rights movement, and that she had strong feelings about the importance of equality and diversity and so on. You know, nevertheless, I haven't really got time to go into that here. It's important to say, though, that race is a big story, which I haven't talked about yet, in the poetry and indeed the settlement of the American suburbs. As I said earlier, urban overcrowding prompted people to begin moving out towards the suburbs. But the urban overcrowding was primarily the influx of new ethnic groups, Puerto Ricans and certainly African Americans from the rural South. So the suburbs grow partly as a consequence of what's since been labelled white flight. White people who could afford to moved away from the increasingly mixed and overcrowded and impoverished cities. Now, one wonderful poem that I found while I was working on the book that this talk is based on is a short, late poem by the well-known African-American poet Langston Hughes. This poem was written in 1967, and it's not terribly well-known. It was published in a journal called Crisis, which is a journal of the National Association for the Advancement of Coloured People, or the NAACP. So Mark's going to read this now. It's just called Suburban Evening, and it's not very long, so listen hard.
A dog howled. Weird became the night. No good reason for my fright, but reason often may play host to quiet, unreasonable ghosts.
So here's the poem in its entirety. It's just 23 words, this poem, mostly monosyllabic, but it plays a number of really subtle, very interesting games. It opens ominously, as Mark read it, a dog howled. For white suburban families, and actually in lots of poems by white suburban poets, the dog, the pet dog, is a reassuring sign of familiarity, of belonging. For Langston Hughes' speaker, and for African-American communities more generally, the dog represents something altogether more threatening, police dogs or guard dogs protecting territory and frightening the interlopers. The night, which in other suburban poems provides a safe space in which to hide, seems suddenly threatening, as we see in line 2, weird became the night. The perceived threat is intangible, perhaps irrational. As he says, no good reason for my fright. But nevertheless, it expresses the speaker's sense of vulnerability in this alien, because white, environment. The shortness of the lines and of the words suggests a need for haste, as though the speaker is looking over his shoulder. And those final lines, which refer to the quiet, unreasonable ghosts, I think represent both past generations of African Americans who've been frightened out of this territory, but the ghosts also represent the shadows or the shades of the white people, because it's the white people who are really the ones who are frightened. And their fear is, in a sense, limiting African American communities' ability to settle in particular areas. It's fair to say that things look quite different for white male suburbanites. And the next poem we're going to listen is one of many I could have chosen, which take the perspective of the slightly alienated, slightly self-pitying white male suburbanite who feels himself to be out of place within his own family, within his own suburb. So this poem by Philip Levine is called Lights I Have Seen Before. It's from his 1963 collection, On the Edge. As I say, it's quite typical and it's kind of quite a self-pitying poem, to be honest. So here's the poem in full. This is perhaps the longest poem we'll hear tonight, Lights I Have Seen Before.
The children are off somewhere. And when I waken, I hear only the buzz of current in the TV. In the refrigerator, groaning against the coming day. I rise and wash. There is nothing to think of except the insistent push of water and the pipes cry against the water. I shave carefully, wanting to say something to someone, wanting to ease myself away from the face that is faintly familiar. Later, at my desk, a young girl cries against the past and the new world she is afraid to enter. She puts her head down, trying to hide what I hear, trying to ask for understanding. And quiets and leaves the memory of no word I can understand. On the way home, houses that are insane spread on my left hand and on my right. I drive on the road between. Between the cry of matter and the cry of those whose lives are here, what is there to choose but failure? What can one say to oneself that will make it believable? And I am on my block, slowing for clusters of children who hear nothing. My next door neighbor sees me and waves as I pass and goes on chasing behind the power mower in a spray of grass. And lights come on where I've seen them before.
Thanks, Mark. So the poem is firmly located in everyday suburban life, although it's got that, Mark and I were talking about this earlier, it's got this incredibly interesting sort of traumatic set of events at the heart of the poem that it doesn't really explain exactly what, but there's this sort of horror in the middle of the poem, bookended by the suburban every day. The reference to children, the accoutrements of modern domesticity, the buzz of current, the refrigerator, they're quite typical of suburban poetry. Here the perspective is strangely out of kilter or elliptical. The children are off somewhere. The speaker's isolated. The half rhymes, only TV and somewhere, refrigerator. The unusual alignment on the page, I think I've got just one stanza of it here. Yeah, two stanzas. You can see there's a very peculiar alignment on the page, which make it seem as though things are just not quite as they should be. The speaker himself is isolated from his family, unable to communicate with others, unable to understand the message that the girl student gives to him. The home itself offers little comfort. In stanza 7, it seems very interesting to me. I haven't got it on this slide, actually. But in stanza 7 that Mark read, he kind of corrects himself. And it's all on one line. He says, on the way home, houses that are insane spread on my left hand and on my right and so on. So he picks home and then almost rejects the word home and changes it to houses partway through the line. So the picture is of this solitary, misunderstood man lost in an environment that seems wholly alien to him. But things perhaps aren't quite as bad as they appear, because somehow the speaker is able to pick a route home between these houses, through this apparent wasteland. And his hidden affection for this place is registered by the possessive my block that we get here, the top line there. My block, I'm on my block. You have this fond reference to the children's happiness. They hear nothing as he approaches because they're happily playing. You've got the friendly wave from the next door neighbour, which is a sign of recognition and welcome. So the suburban home, which in the morning had seemed to repel the speaker, seems now to welcome him back. It seems like a haven, sending out this reassuring beacon of the lights that come on where I've seen them before. So even in this poem, which has got this kind of buried trauma at the heart, suburbia by the end is sustaining on a kind of emotional and a poetic level. Just before we finish, I'd like to turn to one really great suburban poem by the acclaimed American poet Richard Wilbur. This is an elegy written in 1948 called To an American Poet Just Dead. And what the poem does, it seems to me, is demonstrate, and yeah, I'll refer you back to Louis Simpson's poem that we looked at right at the beginning about how I'm taking part in a great experiment where the writers can live peacefully in the suburbs and not be bored to death. You know, the suburbs are just this awful deathly space. But Wilbur's poem, it seems to me, shows us that poetry has a place in suburbia and vice versa, that suburbia has a place in poetry. So in this wonderful poem, this is the last one that Mark's going to read, we see Wilbur blending the conventions of traditional English poetry, the pastoral, the elegy, the lyric, to really compelling effect.
In the Boston Sunday Herald, just three lines of no-point type for you who used to sing the praises of imaginary wines and died, or so I'm told, of the real thing. Also gone, but a lot less forgotten, are an eminent cut-rate druggist, a lover of giving, a lender, and various brokers. Gone from this rotten, taxable world to a higher standard of living. It is out in the comfy suburbs I read you are dead, and the soupy summer is settling, full of the yawns of Sunday fathers loitering late in bed, and the shh of sprays on all the little lawns. Will the sprays weep wide for you their chaplet tears? For you will the deep freeze units melt and mourn? For you will Studebakers shred their gears and sound from each garage a muted horn? They won't. In summer, sunk and stupefied, the suburbs deepen in their sleep of death. And though they sleep the sounder since you died, it's just as well that now you save your breath.
So what Wilbur's doing here is setting up this at first jokey comparison between the city and the comfy suburbs, between the failed poet with his insulting no-point typeface on his obituary, and the others who died on the same day, the merchants, the philanthropists, the brokers, those whose lives are a lot less forgotten. And the poem seems at first to be confirming Louis Simpson's view that the suburb is an inauspicious, a deathly place for poetry. But it seems to me that in its middle section, the poem turns and really magnificently demonstrates suburbia's place in poetry and the suburban poet's right to speak. The middle stanza, which is rich with symbolism and with sibilance, sets that suburban pastoral scene beautifully. And the next stanza takes the conventions of the elegy, the flutes and pipes, the flowing fountains, the procession of mourners, and reworks them for the suburban present day, turning them into lawn sprays, melted ice, crunching gears, and the muted horns of the cars. Is that stanza again? In effect, what the poem is doing is setting up its own impossibility and then proving itself through its own kind of poetic devices. The poem's asking whether it's possible to have a suburban elegy, and it almost tells us it's not possible, but actually disproves that argument in its own form. So it asks whether it's possible to have a suburban elegy and a suburban poetics, and proves against the odds that it is. These silent spaces, hence the shh of sprays in stanza 3 and the muted horn of stanza 4, the sleep of death in stanza 5, these spaces may not toll the bell that we expect of an elegy, but they do produce a new kind of song of mourning, one which is quiet and subtle and deceptive. So just to conclude, what this poem and the other poems I've talked about show us, finally, is that suburbia provides a rich poetic resource, as valuable, as intriguing, as suggestive as the country and as the city. And in the hands of these skillful writers, poetry can and does live in the suburbs. Thanks.